Welcome to Diversity Connects Us. This podcast highlights lived experiences and inspirational stories of strength and tenacity. We will share profound and courageous dialogues that influence diversity, equity, and inclusion by breaking the barriers and labels of stereotypes, confronting biases, and offering best practices to achieve a more significant, cultural, and emotionally intelligent mindset. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much again for joining us today. I have a request. If you value the show, the stories, the wisdom and inspiration, and if you view me as your confidant, as some of you have said, and that you feel with me, please do me a favor. And I also trust you. So you go to Spotify, Apple Podcast, leave us a review and feedback. This keeps our audience engaged. And also, I know what topics that you enjoy the most, so I can bring more of that to you. I have something else for you. By supporting my work, I would love you to go to Amazon. The title of my book is Emotional Intelligence, a Toolkit for Managing Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Please leave us a review. It will only cost you a cup of coffee, depending on where you are. Today, we have an amazing guest, and he is going to unpack us with wisdom, scenarios, and stories just made for you. I see him smiling in the background. He will have you feeling fired up and inspired. So have you ever wondered why DEIB and leaders, or what DEIB and leaders can do to track their efforts? Our special guest today will unpack this for us. My name is Rochelle Carrier. And I'm EQ coach, and I help leaders reframe their mindset through an emotionally intelligent lens through thought-provoking webinars and workshops. You can find me on LinkedIn or at hello@seqconsulting.co. Join us as we share the different voices in the DEI space. Today with us is Pascal Losambe, and I'm going to introduce him. Pascal, how are you?
I'm doing well, Rochelle. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and spend this time with you. What a privilege.
Oh, thank you so much. And how are you today? And please, you know, tell the audience a little bit about you.
Yes, I'm well. And congratulations on your new pieces of work that you mentioned. I cannot wait to pick it up and really improve that aspect of my leadership, especially in this space. My name is Dr. Pascal Losambe. I am a scholar, author. I'm really passionate about creating spaces of belonging for people to find their voice and to really unlock their true potential in different spaces. My background is such that I grew up in South Africa, but my family hails from the Congo. I was born in Nigeria. So my journey through these different countries has really sparked my passion and my work as well. And I've carried the stories and experiences. You know, there's a book called The Body Keeps the Score. And in that book, it talks about how your body learns emotions, especially from your experiences, and keeps those emotions. And so this work of belonging, where I remember and recall spaces where I felt as though I was supported, I was valued, I was connected, really brought the best out of me. And spaces where I did not, really started to make me question my worth and my identity in some ways. And so that's why I'm really passionate about this work. We moved to Burlington, Vermont when I was at the tail end of my high school career. I finished that up at Burlington High. Go Seahorses. Went on to Middlebury College to study molecular biology and biochemistry. And then I went on to Boston College to study biology with a focus on neurobiology. And I got a PhD in educational leadership with a focus on cultural competence. And the reason I tell you that is that I'm very passionate about neurobiology of belonging. We've just released a book. I wrote it with my wife called Breaking the Barriers to Belonging, where I bring parts of this notion of neurobiology and DEI and bring them together, explaining our minds and how it works and how we behave in certain ways in different spaces as well. And so that's where my work collides. I've worked as a diversity practitioner for many years, and I love the conversation we're going to have today about metrics and how to measure and how to keep ourselves accountable to really elevating an environment of belonging for our stakeholders as well. So I hope, Rachel, I did a good job of answering your question a little bit here.
You did. And you did such a good job that I thought to ditch all the questions and to dig deep into neurobiology and DEI. But we will still continue with the questions. And then, you know, given our time frame, then I'll pick your brain about neurobiology and DEIB, because I have a ton of questions already based on that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Great. So what do you think are the five critical metrics to keep in a DEIB program?
You know, Rachel, it's so important for us to keep data. You know, let me start maybe big picture and then I'll drill down to answer your question specifically. Data is so important. You know, when Carter does his work about organizational change, he talks about creating a sense of urgency. And in today's age, we're very subjective in the way we approach this work, you know, and sometimes, our subjectivity is our objectivity, but sometimes people who might not share our identities need data in order to infuse a more objective measure, some evidence behind what you say is necessary. So data is so helpful that way. When I do my consulting work, it's so evident that there's a business case for DEI, and part of that is also keeping metrics. I was reading an account the other day that said every time we lose a person in an organization, it takes about 8 months for that person to come up to speed. And so the organization loses a lot with time, loses a lot with resources to train the individual, expertise, production, all those costs. And so if we can keep data and metrics on how people are doing in the organization, I think it's so important for us and the business case. So there's a kind of a moral obligation, and also there's a business case for this work. The first thing I would say is the one important metric that I think is so important to keep in an organization is how people are doing. So this can come in the form of surveys or focus groups. But there's a nuance to that I want to add. You know, a lot of times when I do my consulting work with organizations, I find that the definition of diversity tends to be a little bit more limited. So people don't see themselves in the metric. So they might take account of race and gender, maybe ability level. But I urge organizations to have a broader definition of diversity by including different dimensions of who people are. So I will infuse a little bit of neurobiology here. Throughout the course of our lives, as we start to live our lives, there's a part of your brain called the reticular activating system that starts to pay attention to you. It starts to pay attention to those aspects of your identity that you will deem important throughout your life. Said a different way, you start to realize that certain parts of your identities, people are going to look at you through, assess you through, and it becomes a frame of reference through which you will see the world. We call these your salient identities. And so imagine somebody is taking a survey and parts of their salient identities are not represented on that survey. Even though the intentions might be good, our brain is always assuming, our brain is always creating a story. Even if the story is not true, it's creating a story of the situation. It's having an explanation of why something occurred. And so that can be a barrier to somebody feeling like they belong. So I've done a lot of talking about these categories. Oftentimes, I feel like people leave out categories. And what I would love you to consider is including gender, yes, including race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, age, disability status, whether you're a veteran, your language, your nationality, educational level, your religion. Those categories are so important, and these are not exclusive, obviously. Your socioeconomic status, these are social identities that your brain has paid attention to throughout the course of your life. And keeping metrics on that, keeping track of that, is really helpful to see how people that share these salient identities are experiencing your culture as well. When we look at an organization, I think that it's also important that if you're doing the work of equity, where you are taking somebody's experience and context, you're looking at various systemic barriers that might have prevented them from gaining access to the door of your organization, that you start to look at your application rates, your selection rates, and divide them by these subgroups, what your performance evaluations are showing. Maybe you are showing a certain data or data points that allow people to maybe see some biases in the way people are evaluating others, your promotion rates, your things like your turnover, voluntary and involuntary. These are important metrics for the organizations to keep. The one issue I have about data is that sometimes it can be largely incomplete. Because you might have heard the platinum rule, that the golden rule says we need to treat people the way we like to be treated. And the platinum rule says we need to treat people the way they want to be treated. And so oftentimes in a survey, we are understanding kind of what the deficits are, what people are saying about how they're experiencing the culture. But I love people to also be solution oriented and allow individuals in your organizations to tell you what it means for them to feel like they belong and what it means for them to feel like they're included. And that can happen in one of a few ways. Number one, you can give a survey that has these prompts. You know, I feel included when you. I feel like I belong when you. I feel like I have a voice in the organization when you. So that allows you to have a solution or an idea of what it means for different individuals that share or differ in certain salient identities to feel as though they are valued, supported, and connected. A lot of the time, our quantitative data must also be coupled with qualitative data. And it's important for us to create safer spaces. Sometimes I have an issue with the word safe space, because is a space truly safe? So I like to use the word safer spaces by doing focus groups or using your employee resource groups to gather data to create a smaller space where people can feel like they can share how they're experiencing the culture, which can be a huge augmentation to the quantitative data that has come about. So the top two, and I'll pause for a second, expand your demographic base because it makes people feel more included. In an organization, look at your different rates of application, selection, promotion, involuntary, voluntary, turnover, so that people can be keeping a pulse on whether there are any systemic biases in the organization that might lead to the disadvantaging of certain groups in your organization as well.
Right. And does that, there's so many things that I want to ask, does that perpetuate toxic workspaces?
Very good question. So Tim Clark wrote this book called The Four Stages of Psychological Safety. And let me describe that to answer your question. So the first level is inclusion safety, meaning, do I have a seat at the table? Do I have a voice in the organization? Then you have contributory safety, where you feel like you can contribute your ideas to the table. You feel like when you are seated, when you have a seat, you can actually contribute your ideas. But the highest form of psychological safety is your ability to challenge the status quo consistently. And so as a result, because we are human, naturally there's going to be friction. And because there's going to be friction, we have to be okay with living within the friction, but having a productive conversation to move the organization forward. So if people don't feel like there is trust or psychological safety in an organization, something like this will be really hard. But companies that work at it, companies that are very intentional about making this a priority for their managers to be able to have counter ideas to the status quo, to be able to question things that will eventually move the organization forward, that is really important. So the level at which you will accept this and do this well also is a function of the level of psychological safety that you have in the organization. And sometimes it just isn't there.
Right. Also in organizations, I think what really needs to happen is to look within also. And, you know, right, when I talk about emotional intelligence and inclusive leadership, it really comes from within. So I think as leaders, we need to also be able to receive the feedback, get the surveys, right, to understand where we are, where our emotional compass is before we leave the house and enter the workspace, because that also can affect the whole staff and all the teams and the whole team. And I believe that we need to check in also with ourselves before entering these spaces so that we know how to manage the team that is going to have various emotions throughout the day, or maybe they had it in the morning before they left the house, and to check in with someone to really ask them, how are you doing? You know, what is it that's going on with you? Just to be able to release it and then to be able to move on. I think also that probably will reduce the turnover rate because now you're really connecting with people on a human level.
Rachel, that's so profound, so well said, and so essential. In my neurobiology work, as I study the brain, it's so important to recognize that we have the emotional brain, you know, the amygdala and structures like that. When the amygdala is engaged, the amygdala is where your fear conditioning resides, what you learn to be afraid of. When you get very emotional about something, when your emotions are high about something, it starts to narrow your focus and it starts to become about you. But when you have an ability to reflect, just like you said, to take a pause and step back, you can access alternative versions of a story you're creating in your mind. Because in your mind, you're always creating a narrative, an explanation for why something is. So somebody might say something to you or do something to you. A story is going to pop into your head. And your ability to reflect will allow you to consider or step back and reconsider revising that story you have in your mind. Because that head talk is often what drives us into defensiveness. And so what you're saying is so true. In order to become more psychologically available, it's so important for us to do what you said. And as we become more psychologically available, we can start to become more available to somebody else and their concerns and their needs. And it takes you out of your own self-centered narrative in many ways.
Right. I love that you said that. I just finished writing an article called How to Reframe Your Narrative and How We Tell Our Stories and What Stories We Tell Ourselves That Actually Shape Our Lives. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy you said that, because when I think personally of, you know, my past, my background, my experiences, you know, the various places that I lived and processing information in my own way, I think that's what developed me to where I am like today. Right. And then yesterday it was a different story, because yesterday I had, you know, a different day. It was a not so great day. So then the narrative was really different then. And, you know, as a leader, you can't be, unless you have the self-awareness to be able to process, today's not a good day. Maybe I shouldn't be making any business decisions. Mm. Right. Because you're coming from an emotional space, as you said, and it narrows down that filter. Yesterday was all about me. It was literally all about me. And then I realized, oh, okay. Can you imagine if I had to walk into a space and I brought in all that energy into the space, then the decisions wouldn't have been the same.
Right. And that's so profound. I love that, Rachel. And I cannot wait to kind of peek at that article a little bit. One thing I often tell leaders is that we have to give ourselves permission to be human as well. So in addition, feeling defensive is not the issue. Feeling angry is not the issue. Feeling sad or vulnerable is not the issue. The issue is, do you have the coping skills to get you back to that place of functionality? So we have to give ourselves permission to be human. We create these stories in our minds. And the question I always have is, what will allow you to cope, or what tools do you have to return you to the level where you can enter your organization being your better self as well? And so part of that is the story that you create, the narrative you create in your head. Part of it is those coping skills and giving yourself permission to have the emotions you have. But then what happens after that is what will differentiate you as effective or not effective.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Michelle Obama, I was watching her on Oprah the last day of her tour of her second book. And that's exactly what she said. You know, she said it's really important to have those emotions, to know those emotions are real. And her and Oprah actually admitted that they have fear every day. But what is it that they have to do to overcome the fear, to take the next steps, to go through the fear? Mm. And as Tony Robbins calls it, just dance with the fear.
Yes.
Here, You dance with it here, you dance with it here, but then you still stay focused on your goal. You know it's there, but then you still stay focused on your goal.
Right.
Yeah. And what is it do you think that DEIB leaders can learn from those metrics?
I think they can learn a lot. When we talk about individual bias, we are biased beings. By the nature of us being human, you are biased because of the fact that your brain is anticipating all the time and it constructs a narrative of what a situation could be. So it's a big simulator. You like to simulate a lot in your minds and in your brains. But when individuals go into an organization and start to make decisions, if you have a group of people that have a negative bias towards people or situations or different identities, that may show up in the data. And so as a result, you go from individual bias to organizational, institutional bias. And so as a result, the data will start to cause you to ask some questions about your organization. And a German company did this. There was a German company, they invested heavily in the market and they were not getting the returns they needed. And so people were really concerned about this, like what is going on? And they found that because of the power distance, people were deferring, lower level employees were deferring decisions to the higher level employees, even though they had a different perspective. So what they saw was that there was this confirmation bias that was happening. They were in an echo chamber and that resulted in the company struggling as a result. And so they did something very beautiful because the data was showing that they were not performing at the level that they could. And so they installed what they called a devil's advocate, which is somebody that would counteract the decision and ask questions and poke holes. And a group of people would do this. And they found that that was really helpful in making a well thought out decision. So that diversity of thought was very important. I bring that example up to showcase that at the end of the day, when they were looking at their metrics, their output compared to their input, they were seeing something that wasn't right, causing them to ask questions about their structure, about their processes. And they saw that there might have been some sort of institutional or structural or organizational bias in there somewhere that they had to kind of counteract as well. So that example showcases, Rachel, that the data often starts to point towards something that causes you to ask deeper questions. There is a phenomenal scholar called Ellen Mandinach, and she says data in itself is meaningless, but when we turn data to information, meaning we put it in context of different identity groups, allowing us to gain knowledge about why certain effects are happening, it can lead to an informed decision at the end of the day. And that's what the strength of what data provides us, an ability to look at our organization and reveal certain things about ourselves, which allows us to be stronger at the end of the day. And when we don't do this and we don't recognize it and when we don't take metrics, we actually make ourselves more fragile. We make our organizations more fragile that way. So we make ourselves better and more resilient as an organization when we do take data, we look at it, we inspect it, we ask questions about it, and that can lead to organizational change in a very favorable way.
Absolutely. I love that. I agree with it. How important do you think it is to have a shared community to lead to shared humanity?
It's so important. Different people will bring different experiences. There's the work by the author Scott Page, and he modeled it. He's a professor at Michigan, and he's an economist, a mathematician, and he modeled this. He said, you know, why does diversity lead to a bonus? Why does it give us kind of a bonus in the way we make decisions? And what he meant by bonus is why does it lead to better outcomes? And he said that it starts with your perception. So, Rachel, you have lived a different experience. You have lived certain realities that I haven't. And there are many that we have shared. But our perspective is different. When we look at an issue, you bring the lens of emotional intelligence. I bring maybe neurobiology, which you bring a very good foundation in psychology, neurobiology as well. But we are nuanced in that. Then that starts to affect our interpretation. Our perspective affects our interpretation, how we are analyzing and making sense of that data. From there, we bring different heuristics, how we move forward to apply our interpretation. So what that means is, if I'm designing a building and I have somebody who's blind in that building, because of the lived experience of that blind individual, they will have a different perception, a different interpretation, likely. And we will start to pay attention to how individuals of different abilities might experience that building. And so that becomes a model that we start to incorporate into our way of thinking. And so as a result, in our shared humanity, meaning that we have different experiences, we have similar needs that are fulfilled in different ways, we can recognize, because of the fact that we have a shared humanity and our differences are part of that humanity that we bring to the table, and recognizing that and respecting that, we can leave space for us to have a productive conversation, diversity of thought. That goes with data. When we look at data, different people will have interpretations of that data, which will allow us in a structured way to lead to a good outcome. I was in an interview once, Rachelle, where I was sitting there and we were screening candidates. And this woman came along and she had been in the same position for 20 years, which causes you to raise questions in today's age of rapid changing of jobs, et cetera. That's kind of the model. And some people were asking the question, is it because this woman didn't have the skills to be promoted? Did the leadership not see something in her to advance her? Why would you stay 20 years? And somebody in the room said, it could be more than what you're thinking. Maybe this person was a mother. Maybe there was a family situation going on that didn't, maybe she was caring for an individual that didn't allow the person to have much flexibility if they moved up in life in the company or the organization. So that diversity of thought, that differential opened up the mind of the committee so that we didn't just judge based on our frame of reference what the person was, what we assumed the person was, had experienced or went through in the organization. So again, interpreting this data needs a diverse team or people from different departments or people that share different identities or people that share a diversity of thought to interpret that data so that it can be a productive outcome, most productive outcome in the end.
Wow. We need a part two. It's amazing how it all boils down, I believe, you know, given your background and my background and how you say, you know, EQ is very nuanced, you know, between EQ and neurobiology and DEIB. I think at the end of the day, it's really important to be able to assess ourselves, right? Before assessing others.
Yes.
Because we're mirror images of the people that we attract in our lives. And, you know, being in organizations and in situations where you have a great responsibility to move the organization forward, if you're not in that forward thinking space to begin with, because of circumstance, like you said, situations or whatever is going on, then it's going to be very difficult to move the organization forward. So what do you want the audience to take away today?
I think it's important. Again, we are talking a little bit about, you know, data and neurobiology, etc. I love Rachelle's work of emotional intelligence because it talks about the human condition. And I love neurobiology because it allows me to understand the brain and the mind and why I behave in certain ways. And so I think it's important for us to delve deeper into this, into human behavior, to understand what somebody else might be going through, because our minds and our brains are very objective. Like, our brains function the same way. If I give you a compliment, Rachelle, and even though you might think I'm doing too much, that compliment will still release oxytocin and dopamine in your brain. It's a very objective, and not in all circumstances. Obviously, I'm overgeneralizing here, but so if we understand the way our minds work and the way people are experiencing the social environment, it allows us to gain more empathy, more compassion, more perspective taking, to recognize that in our shared humanity, we are all trying to fulfill very similar needs. And because, and as Brené Brown says, I'm a huge Brené Brown fan, our biography affects our biology, which affects our backstory which affects our behavior. So our experiences in life, our identities, what we've grown up believing and thinking affects the way we think and the way we perceive the world. And that's how it affects our backstory, how we react to different situations. As a result, it influences our behavior. So oftentimes we sit in the stage of judging people's behavior without also appreciating that our biography affects our biology, which affects our backstory. So there's more depth to each and every single one of us. Self-reflection will allow that. When you know yourself, you have the better ability to empathize and perspective take. When you take data, there's a more objective measure for you to understand your organization. So drill deeper into the humanity we share and also appreciate the differences we bring to the table. And that will hopefully help us move forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love that. And you know, it's interesting. I know we're coming to the top of the Diversity Connects Us hour, but there's also a little story. My daughter came home yesterday and said, "Oh, the teacher hurt my feelings." And I said, "Well, how did he hurt your feelings?" And she said, because she had to go to the office, her thumb was hurting her, and he just pushed her on the side. He's like, "I don't want to see it. Don't show it to me. Just go to the office." So, you know, the school called me and XYZ. So I said, Mr. Francois doesn't have any children yet. And he doesn't know how yet. I said, I know he's a teacher, but maybe that's something that really bothers him. And he doesn't have the space yet to be able to handle it because there's 25 others, little ones like you in the class. So, but I know he didn't show empathy, but it made her feel bad. So I validated the emotion, but yet I tried to show her that his experience is completely different from a mom who might have one child or two child or a teacher who might have three kids, who's always getting bruised and hurt and seeing all this, you know, health issues. So it was a very interesting perspective. She was quiet after that. After I said, "My mom, my feelings are hurt." I said, "Yeah, I understand your feelings are hurt, but I said, he doesn't have any children yet." And I said, "But that's okay. So he doesn't understand. And maybe it's not something he wants to deal with right now."
So right? Powerful. I love that example. I love that example. Because it shows the nuance. It shows the, you know, as we look at the brain of adolescents, you know, their emotional brains are far more developed than their higher order thinking. So they might process a situation a little bit more from that emotional brain. But what you did was you took the conversation higher and you created alternative interpretations that now will stick with your child in that higher order thinking part of the brain that she will be able to access later. And so I'm so glad that you were a presence enough to kind of explore different possibilities in that situation.
Right. Absolutely. I think it's a work in progress for all of us. It's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. We definitely need a part two because I know we can take this further. Yes. It was absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for listening. Before we leave today, show some love for your favorite podcast. Leave us a review on Apple and Spotify podcasts. Pascal Losambe, it was a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's a joy to join you. Thank you for the work you're doing. It's really so meaningful for us to dialogue about this. And we are making, you know, Robert Livingston says it best, we might not be able to boil the ocean, but we are boiling our kettle and we're going to dump it into the ocean. So you're doing your part to advance this narrative in a powerful way. So thank you for allowing me to be part of that.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you also for the work that you're doing. We need more like you. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
As we reach the top of the Diversity Connects Us Hour, I want to thank all of my listeners for tuning in. My name is Rochelle Carrier, and I'm a DEI personal consultant and EQ coach and authoress of two ebooks, Emotional Intelligence, a Toolkit for Managing Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, and Know Yourself to Know Your Employees. The link to purchase the ebooks are in the show notes. Also, be on the lookout for my and Dr. Rudell's coaching workshops, presentations, and webinars. I also want to thank my producer, Titan32. That's his tag name on Fiverr.com. He does our beautiful edits. To trend with us, #DiversityConnectsUs.